All right, so I'm going to be talking about the kinematics of molecular cloud cores in driven and decaying turbulence, and I will hopefully make some interesting comparison with observations. So my collaborators are Mark, Chris, and Richard, and Mark and Chris are here, and I'm glad that Mark has shown up so he can answer questions for me. Yeah. All right, so first I will briefly discuss the simulations that I've done. Then I will talk about how we can post-process these simulations in order to make simulated observations of our data, which we can compare with actual observations of molecular clouds. So from this post-process data, we extract kinematic information, including core velocity dispersions, core centroid velocities, and dispersion of the centroids. And finally, I will make some observational comparisons. So the simulations are 3D isothermal hydrodynamic AMR simulations with self-gravity. They have an effective resolution of 2048 cubed. They have a 1D Mach number of 5, and we drive on scales with wave numbers between 3 and 4. The calculations also have sync particles. Because they're isothermal, we can scale them to a number of appropriate parameters. Here's one scaling for T equals 20 Kelvin. We have around 1,000 solar masses and within 2 par 6 cubed. Yes? Well, so I think either of them is fine. I think the typical, we started out doing this a number of years ago, and it's been more recently that we've started to move towards, you know, well, it should be really large scale driving, not just moderately large scale. Yeah, I'm sorry we made a bad choice, Paolo.
Well, actually, you haven't checked this in the hydro case, but in the MHD case, it turns out that we think you actually need to drive an even higher K. And the reason is that we find that if you go ahead and drive a K of 1 and 2, we get very large-scale rotational motion. So you essentially have flux of field line just kind of rotating around, which is very unphysical. Whereas if you drive at high K, then that doesn't happen.
You also get something like an inverse cascade, and you can, even in a hydro K, you open it more and more.
Yeah. Right, but everything we're looking at here is on much smaller scales than K equals 3 or 4, so it basically doesn't matter. Yeah. Everything we're looking at here is tiny compared to a quarter of the box size.
Yeah, probably because your main goal is that in this course, maybe.
Right,
maybe.
Yeah.
How does the gene's length compare with the size of the box?
I think it's a factor, the gene's length's a factor of several, maybe 5 or something below the length of the box. I don't remember what it is exactly for this particular calculation.
Discussion in this 2 to 3, wave numbers 2 to 3 for the driving, I mean, my reason for driving between 2 to 3 could be that it's more isotropic on there between 1 and 2.
With
1 and 2, you have very few wave numbers that go diagonally, and of none, of course, which do anything else than diagonally and coordinate directions.
Yeah, but this is the usual argument that is given for using those for number, but the point is that you can beat that by running over many dynamical times, and then you do average over time instead of space, but you can never increase the inertial length of the turbulence if you instead choose this choice. And so the other, your problem can be solved by averaging over time. Mm-hmm. The problem of a less tangential range is not solved. I mean, you're stuck with it. When you
I think you're thinking of something else. I think you're thinking of the calculation of the structure functions. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the isotropy of the actual turbulence that you get in the box.
Yes, but the isotropy is measured when you average. The isotropy is a statistical quantity too. It's measured when you take averages, and you have options of taking averages both over space and time.
Right.
And since you can change your random numbers over time, for example, every dynamical time, then you do recover averaging over time isotropy anyway. You don't need to add necessarily isotropy in space.
What about the driving force? Is it
the fixed pattern?
The fixed pattern.
Right.
The fixed pattern, you can easily I think, drive on the K1 and 2, because you can choose, you need to take care of picking the right random number combination that will give you isotropic drive field. That's the key. If you just pick one, you may get rotation or something strange. But if you are careful enough to pick an isotropic realization of that, then you'll help you.
All right, so as you can tell, this is supposed to be a comparison with observational data and not a discussion of the wave numbers of use. So I'd hope to spend as little time as possible discussing the actual simulations. So someone else following this work can do a study with different wave numbers as they so choose. All right, so the point is, we drive the turbulence for two crossing times to set up the cascade without self-gravity. Then we split it into two different cases, one in which we continue to drive the turbulence on these scales and fix the Mach number and virial parameter, essentially. And the second, in which we turn the driving off and allow the turbulence to decay.
Just a short note.
Yes.
Two crossing times is not enough to get statistical.
Well, I actually did look at the statistics, and you do have a paper in which you plot like the PDF and the power spectrum, and I did look at those things, and they're totally reasonable, K to the minus 2 at this time, and the PDF matches what you guys have in the paper.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've looked at that. I mean, it's not your, base grid 1024 cube, but it's decent. It's reasonable. I've looked at it. No, it's turned on after two crossing times.
So, Sarah, you think it converges faster because you're driving in smaller scales? Because the crossing time used for the rhythm of the K1 and K2,
right?
You're driving K3 and K4, it should converge faster.
Right, that's probably part of it. Yeah. All right, so here are these two simulations, and they're observed as if they were a distance of 150 parsecs away with a beam size of 26 arcseconds. So as you can see, there are already substantial differences in the geometry of the two clouds, which are visually apparent. All right, so 2 weeks ago, Doug Johnstone gave a talk in which he sort of pleaded with computationalists and theorists to try and meet the observers halfway, and that is that they're providing a ton of statistical information about a bunch of different properties of these cloud cores, and they would like us to look at some other things. So little did he know that I was already working on the kinematic information and actually comparing to the data in one of his papers. So this work was inspired by a number of recent papers looking at kinematic information in Roof and Perseus. So in terms of radiatively post-processing our simulations, we like to stick as close to what the observers are actually doing as possible. So the first thing observers typically do is they look at a map in the millimeter, and they pick out cores as local maxima. So we can generate such a map from our data by first assuming that our domain is optically thin at 1 millimeter. Then through this, that the dust intensity is proportional to the column density via some dust-to-gas ratio that's fixed. When we have that map, we can convolve it with the appropriate beam size for a particular cloud distance. Finally, we can identify cores as local maxima in this map, which is what we've done. Next, we would like to make molecular line observations of our identified cores. So we're considering the tracers C18O, N2H+, and ammonia. So we picked these in particular because CO tends to trace lower density gas, which is frequently used to tracers, for example, core envelopes, and N2H+ and NH3 trace the higher density core centers. So most low-mass star-forming regions are optically thin, so we make that approximation. Next, we assume the gas is in statistical equilibrium. When we write this down, we neglect radiative pumping, except in the case for excitation, de-excitation from the CMB, which really only affects the ammonia, which has a transition near the peak there. So using this information, we can calculate the emergent intensity in each pixel and each velocity channel as a function of density. Finally, we can integrate over this along the line of sight to get the specific intensity. We can then smear the data for the appropriate observational resolution and generate a position velocity cube. So in addition to this analysis, we also adopt a very simple depletion model. That is, we know that CO freezes out onto grains, and you know these nitrogenated species become basically depleted at very high densities. So we are going to take this into account by assuming a constant abundance chi with some depletion cutoff above which chi is zero.
What is the mean density?
So it depends on what region we're normalizing to. For example, if we normalize to Perseus, the mean density is around 10 to the 3.
So you hardly reach those. One also,
Right. So we definitely do, particularly in the very dense cores, and we have sink particles, so there is a region that's not being traced.
You may not put it in the loop for the densest core, but
But that's, I mean, that's what's observed. If you look at cores and see how holes in the
belt. I'm not saying it's wrong, you know, I'm just trying to get a feeling
So the first statistic that we look at here are the velocity dispersions along the line of sight through each core center. Now I've plotted this for in the tracer N2H+, where I have the total cores for the decaying and driven simulations. So at first glance, these two actually look pretty similar. They both have peaks at around 1, and they both have some high dispersion cores out here. So we can figure out what's going on if we break this into the pre-stellar and protostellar cases. So you can immediately see that the protostellar cases are basically responsible for all of this high dispersion stuff out here, which is basically infall. Now the pre-stellar cores are much more quiescent, and they're peaked around the sound speed. So in summary from this, the pre-stellar cores have subsonic second moments, the typical core, whereas the protostellar cores tend to have either transonic or slightly supersonic second moments.
So when you compare, when you do the statistics, the decaying turbulence and the driven turbulence have the same Arrhenius Mach number at this stage? No,
they don't. So at this stage, for example, we're looking at it at one free fall time, and at that time, we have Mach 5 for the driven and around Mach 2 for the decaying. So there's been substantial change.
But not much.
Yeah, surprisingly enough.
So, what are the sensitivities to when you turn on the gravity in your calculations?
In terms of running for, you know, looking at the statistics at half a free fall time? Yeah, I have. And qualitatively, we get fairly similar results. The details change a little bit. From what I can tell, the driven almost always looks the same in terms of the number of cores that are being produced and their statistics. And the decaying changes a little bit over time because the reason is, as the turbulence decays, less new cores are being created, so you start getting more and more, a higher percentage of protostellar cores and fewer prestellar cores. So that changes the overall distribution over time. Yes?
Thank you, Joan. I'm looking at the numbers, of course, say you have 108 and 114, but on the maps I couldn't count that
many. So in order to increase statistics, we actually look at it along each dimension. So we look at an XY projection, a YZ projection, and then we assume that those are independent observations since we're just looking at a 2G projection.
So you're looking at three versions.
Yeah. So the next statistic is the centroid velocities, which essentially represent the bulk motion of the cores. So I plotted here the distributions for all the cores normalized to the gas dispersion at one free fall time. So as I just said, for the decaying case, it's around 2. For the driven case, it's around 5. So you can see for these particular distributions, this dashed line here is a Gaussian with the same dispersion as the distribution. The dot dashed line here on the outside is the dispersion of the gas. So you can see that in both cases, it's slightly subvarial relative to the gas dispersion. So we can break this up again into prestellar and protostellar cores. So So the decaying here is on the left. And you can see that the prestellar cores are more subvirial, whereas the protostellar cores are approximately virial, which seems sort of funny at first sight because it seems to imply that the protostellar cores are scattering or interacting as much as the gas is in order to virialize. However, we can also think of this as a clock in the simulation, because recall that the protostellar cores are likely older and form at an earlier time when the gas dispersion is higher, whereas the prestellar cores are younger and form later. So if these cores somewhat remember the initial dispersion of the gas that they form out of, then that could be reflected in these distributions. Yes? Right. Right. So the protostellar are the cores with zinc particles.
Turn off a zinc particle when?
When we exceed the resolution of the calculation. So on the maximum level, when we go to level 4, for example, and when we exceed the genes condition on that level, we introduce a zinc particle.
So what physical scale would that be?
Well, the resolution the resolution might be around 200 AU for the conditions that I gave at the beginning. So that's the cell size resolution. The number density, I forget what that is, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 8, something like that. I don't remember.
How many levels do you find them?
Four.
Four levels, so your phase view is 128?
Right.
And what's the criterion for refinement?
Genes criterion. We use a genes number of 0.25.
In the triple case,
the protostellar distribution is not clear that it's peaked at one, no?
The bottom
right
is different from the bottom left.
Right, right. That is sort of interesting. Yeah, the peak is slightly different. I mean, the cores have some bulk motion, and it's in one direction or another.
The spherical velocity in the decaying is
Well, can I understand what he's trying to ask first? I'm not really sure.
What I'm trying to say is that the bottom right plot might be self-similar over time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the bottom left
might change a little bit. Well, actually, what is most interesting is that we find that looking at comparing these distributions with a KS test, they're statistically similar. So though you see by eye that, you know, the peaking is slightly different, they're actually almost indistinguishable. So I'll get to that a little bit later, but yeah.
What direction is it?
No, so this is the bulk motion of the core. So it's whether it's going, you know, towards you or away from you. Yeah.
Sorry, what are the curves?
Okay. So, right, so the dashed line is a fit, a Gaussian, with the dispersion of the data. And the dot dashed line is a Gaussian with the dispersion of the gas. So in the case where the dot dashed line is outside, it's subvirial. If it goes inside, you know, it's supervirial. So the next thing that we would like to look at is what's going on in the surrounding environment for the core. So what we can do is make a plot where we actually look at the velocity dispersion in each pixel, and that's plotted in this color bar here. And overlaid on this are the contours that represent column density in the particular trace that we're looking at. So this is C18O here, this is N2H plus here. So I've shown two plots here, which are sort of typical examples of this particular type of core. So here's a prestellar core, right? And as we expect, the envelope here actually looks more turbulent than the interior, which is fairly quiescent. Okay, so in this case, there's no infall, and it's still in the process, probably, of forming. So this is in contrast to the protostellar case. In the protostellar case, you can see the contours are very, very concentrated in the center, and there's a very high dispersion here, which is represents very strong infall. In contrast, the envelope, the C18O, is not really tracing that at all, and it tends to be almost transonic. I think there is a disk in there, but you know, we're smearing it to match the observation so we don't resolve it.
Sorry, you mentioned this observation, what the
resolution? So the angular resolution for Perseus is around 31 arc seconds, and it's a distance of 260 parsecs away. Yeah, well, we're matching, since we're tracing this in CO and N2H+, we're using the resolutions that the papers use that we compare with, and that's, you know, their resolution.
Is this your proven?
This is actually the decaying one. I'm not so concerned about which is which so much as this is a pretty typical prestellar core, and this is a pretty typical protostellar core. So because we have something like a total of 300 cores, we can't really distinguish by eye the differences between the two calculations. So what I've done is make a single average core. So for example, I take all the starless cores in the decaying simulation and do a radial average around the center and then sum over all of them. Okay, so I get a single average core. And then I can plot this dispersion as a function of radius going out from the core center. So you can see that this is a typical starless core here. And the black lines are the driven CO, N2H+, and NH3. And the red lines are the undriven. So the first thing that you notice here is that it's actually pretty coherent. Like, this is flat. And this definitely agrees with the early observations by Branco and Goodman, I think, in 98. That they observed the cores to be pretty coherent. The next thing, it's very much like the prestellar core I showed you in the last slide, in that the C18O, tracing the less dense gas, is higher than the other tracers. So here's C18O here in this constant line, and here's C18O for the undriven case here. Right. So, and then this is in contrast to the protostellar case, which looks very different, very much like the typical core that core map that I showed you earlier. In this case, the envelopes in both cases are fairly quiescent. These are the C18O here. Whereas you're starting to see development of infall here and very strong infall in the decaying case. So we have a really sharp increase towards the center.
Sorry, the coherence on the left means that, actually it's a question, does it mean that the integration of the line of sight is dominated by a region that is larger than 0.1 parsec? Hence, you do see the envelope as shown by the increase in velocity from C18O. But you don't see its radial dependence because you...
Well, no, what it's supposed to represent is we're supposed to be actually probing the core. And we're supposed to... These densities are above the average density in the box, the window that we're looking at. But it is supposed to represent that the cores are quiescent and that the inner region is not infalling. It's not, you know, it's calm, basically.
Is
What
coherent means?
Yeah.
Quiescent.
Well, coherent. Well, in their sense, coherent is what I meant, constant, that they observed a flat dispersion with radius. And as an example, a recent example, this was shown at Chamonix by André et al. And it's basically a prestellar core, and he's mapped the dispersion. He's made a dispersion map, which is the color bar, just like I have, and then these contours are the column density. You can see it looks fairly flat. It's coherent. So that's sort of what is meant. For this particular case, the maximum is around 1.7 times the sound speed. So that's certainly in agreement with typical cores in both cases. Yes?
What's the typical number of cells you have, for example, in the smallest core? So how many cells does it resolve?
Well, let's see. So... Okay, so this is going out to 0.1 parsec, and a typical resolution might be 200 AU. So there might be hundreds of cells in here. But we've binned this into, say, 20, 25 bins or something, so we've broken it up. So now we'd like to compare to actual observational data, in particular Roof here and Perseus. So already these two clouds are very different. So rho is about 1 parsec squared in the region that's forming stars, whereas Perseus is this really elongated filamentary structure here, which is quite massive, around 18,000 solar masses. So in order to compare them, we do KS tests between the observational characteristics and the data that we have from the simulations. So the data that I've taken is from Andre, representing Roof, and he looks at starless cores in N2H+. Kirk et al. Look in Perseus, and they separate their sample of maybe 100 or so cores into starless and protostellar. So and Roslowski also looks at Perseus, but in ammonia, and he gives a combined total of around 200 starless and protostellar cores. So the first thing is the first moments, that is the bulk motions of the cores. And so looking at the Kirk et al. Sample from Perseus, we actually get decent agreement, 10%, for both driven and undriven, and not so great agreement for the driven and undriven with Eric's data. So the first thing this signifies is that not only are the simulation statistically similar, as I mentioned before, but they're actually fairly statistically similar with the observed data. And this continues down for the other. Yes.
So why, but you say that it doesn't work so well across the data.
Right. So, well, there are more cores, but one thing I have to do in order to compare is to subtract out large-scale gradients. For some reason, prior to subtracting it out, Kirk and Eric data is fairly similar, but once I subtract them out, they get further apart in terms of the distributions. So I'm not really sure why that is.
But you have the histograms, so
Well, I haven't plotted the histograms with this data here. So I have made cumulative distribution functions for this. And if you plot this, you can see by eye that it looks fairly similar. Yeah. Well, sometimes the eye can fool one. All right, so for the second moments, you can see that the agreement is a lot worse. So for the second moments are the velocity dispersions through the core center. And you can see that it's not agreeing well with the Kirk sample of Perseus, but there's some marginal agreement with Eric's ammonia data. For the starless core samples, you recall that from the plots, they were more subsonic in terms of the typical core. And these actually are agreeing a little bit better. For example, in Roof, we get about a 25% agreement. So that's pretty good. In contrast, the protostellar cores, again, don't agree very well. And we understand this because we're comparing with data from Perseus, and they actually don't really observe strong infall in their protostellar cores. So it makes sense that it doesn't agree very well with this test.
Okay, so the top right ones. So the probabilities are low, but how are they different? In what sense are they different?
So in what sense are the two simulations different, or in what sense?
So
for the net sample, maybe half the cores are protostellar. And you'll recall the protostellar cores, if they have an infall signature, then they tend to have a large dispersion. And since the observational data don't show, you know, supersonic dispersions, then it doesn't agree. There's also the details of where the peak of the distribution falls. And I think those are slightly different in the different cases. So it's a case of, you know, what the tail is doing in the distribution and also where the actual peak is.
What are you plotting horizontally?
All right. So I'll just go back to the beginning. All right. So the two places you can disagree, right, are where the peak is and how much noise is out here, you know, how high are the dispersions, right? So the observations, you know, do see something like this. You recall there's 25% agreement with Andre's data. So, I mean, he has a pretty peaked distribution just like this one. And this one has a little bit more higher dispersion, which is slightly less in agreement.
That's just a prestellar. When you put in a protostellar,
yeah,
that's where the problem is.
So like those long tails on the protostellar in both cases.
All right. So this is my summary slide. So in summary, both simulations find sonic prestellar second moments in Burr typical core. However, the decaying simulation has these supersonic protostellar second moments. There's a lot of noise in the tail distribution, whereas the driven simulation has approximately transonic second moments. For the first moments, we find that both the observations and the simulations are statistically similar in some cases. So both simulations overall are slightly subvarial, but the driven has approximately varial prestellar moments, while the decaying simulation has approximately varial protostellar moments. For the core envelopes, both simulations have coherent prestellar cores, which is similar to observation. But the driven simulation has approximately transonic protostellar envelopes that are more flat with the radius, whereas the decaying simulation really has strong infall, such that the protostellar envelopes increase with decreasing radius. So in this particular case, the driven simulations are a slightly better matched to observations. So overall, a lot more work needs to be done. And as we discussed in the beginning, there are a number of missing elements, either from the simulations, like magnetic fields, or perhaps people would like to, you know, do different driving. So I think the observers would be extremely happy to hear from all computationalists and all results that we can give them in terms of comparisons. So, thank you.
Compared with Andrew Walsh's paper, because again we did something similar.
Right.
That was not looking at core dispersions, but envelope.
Right. So that was interesting, and I recall looking at that, and what you guys found is you found this profile too. Like, I don't know if you were looking at the prestellar stuff, but I did recall that you were marked on that.
No, we found the trend going from stars to protostellar in the sense that the high density dispersion increases and the low density dispersion stays about the same or maybe decreases or so. So there's a trend with time.
Right.
And Andrew Walsh's observations were looking at stars cores.
Right.
But I seem to remember, too, that from Walsh's paper, the stardust cores, the velocity dispersion of the N2H mask was a lot more significantly narrower than the C18O, which would be more like the rather than the driven turbulence in that.
Yeah, so what I haven't shown here is something that you need to be sort of careful of. If you don't do this analysis here and you try and look through all the gas and don't take into account depletion and some other stuff, then you can get really high dispersions, higher than I've shown. And I think that has been reported in some papers, including one that Klessen did. So you have to be a little bit careful about the analysis and what the observers are actually seeing and what, you know, trying to match that. Yes?
So just a little bit more about the superparticles here. There's quite a different behavior that when you turn on a sync, just put it in numerical language, you turn on the sync particle at that scale.
Right.
I take it, I personally haven't been involved in the sync particles, but I've listened to discussions about these things. And I was just wondering, how much of that could be just to the presence of the sync particle with different properties in the gas. In other words, if you make your resolution much better, and you put a sicker particle, would you see the same behavior?
Right.
Just that kind of convergence?
So one thing that Chris actually brought up is that we're missing physics of the sync particle. So mass just falls onto the sync particle and stays there. But in reality, there are outflows. So certainly, if you're kicking mass out and you limit the mass of the sync particle, you will get less strong infall profiles. So that is one effect.
I agree, but let's say that there aren't both outflows. The physics that you're trying to give here, you're changing pressure, presumably, when you're both in the sync particle. How are the pressures treated? Is the gas outside now see something happening?
So it depends on the
infall. If the infall is supersonic, then it doesn't matter.
But before it goes supersonic, then it could have anything.
But in general, you know, your goal when putting in a sync particle is to only put it in once the inflow is, you know, completely supersonic, and so there are no signals propagating out of the sync particle we
interested. Yeah, well, that's why it's because some of these are just that transonic type of levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, there may be some wisdom in the community about how to treat sync particles. I take it, but it's still an interesting issue. I'm just wondering whether these transitions can be checked, by altering the size of the sync cell. It seems like there's a lot of interesting things you could investigate right here. These transitions.
But I think the sync particles are, on this scale, so you said it's 200 AU, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the size of a single cell or the size of the accretion zone?
That's a single cell.
Okay, so the accretion zone is four times that, so let's just call it 1,000 AU. So it's 10 to the 16 centimeters in that 0.01 parsecs. So the accretion, so maybe inside that 0.01 parsecs, you can get some effects from the accretion zone. But once you're sort of outside of 0.01 parsecs, you're pretty far from it.
But the other thing is, you can't avoid sync particles by changing your equation state. So if you're keeping the simulation going by having a hot fault, there's a little bit of a fault that you can try and as well.
Right. But that's probably not more physically realistic.
Yeah. No, but
yeah.
You can see it made a big effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing is, coming back, ignore outflows, but the other thing I was told when we did our comparison was that N2H plus is actually destroyed by outflows.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, when you get to protostars, maybe it's not really given the input physics and trying to compare the observations. A lot more that goes on in destruction of N2H plus and so on, and maybe makes it a bit less reliable than if it's still on.
Right, that's also a possibility. I mean, the chemistry is very complicated, and we admit that, and we've done a very simplified job of dealing with that. So it's fixed pattern driving. We generate a random pattern top hat distribution between K3 and 4. Every step, we add a velocity perturbation. So, and for the continued driving, we say, all right, we're going to have a Mach number of 5, so we drive as soon as we fall below the Mach number that we're trying to maintain.
It would be interesting to try a simulation with a larger root grid and with the same effect resolution and to see what differences you get. Because at 128 root grid and requirement on chain's length, it's not very well resolving turbulence.
Right. So, we did have some discussion of this, and we did look at your paper, and I think you plotted 256, 512, 1024, these distributions. And in general, between the different base groups, there was not that much, from my opinion, improvement in terms of the statistics of what you were getting.
Problem is if you have the supersonic clouds, there are certain density-velocity correlations that get established in the inertial range. But all the formation of sync particles and all the collapses you model in this are happening basically in the dissipation range, where numerical dissipation dominates, and so that's the worry. So you might be getting wrong combinations of velocities and densities.
So if I were Chris, I would say that, this driving stuff is science fiction anyway. So, maybe we shouldn't be too worried about the details. Yes.
So is it a fundamental problem that we do, whenever you turn on a sync particle, so wherever your code recognizes that something is collapsing in the center of the core, with or without magnetic field, you will add some free fall there.
Right. Right.
No question about it. And so, what is that maybe missing? Why is it that we never see essentially this supersonic inflow in the observation?
Right. So, there are a couple of things that could be going on. So, some infall is observed, but not strongly in whatever cores they're looking at Perseus. But it may also be, you know, it could be a magnetic field issue with our simulations. It sort of retards the collapse and slows things down. Or it could be partially a tracer, a chemical issue with the observations. Maybe they're not probing as deep in as we're trying to do here. I mean, it's...
So, yeah, but there... But all the tracers are supersonic version there. You mean that if you actually decrease the threshold for collision for all the tracers, you wouldn't see supersonic?
Well, certainly this has a much lower depletion. You can see it goes away in this tracer. But I don't think that that's a whole effect. I think there's probably a combination of things, from the inclusion of magnetic fields, the inclusion of outflows, and there's a lot of different physics here, in addition to the chemistry, which is either not included in the simulation or also not well understood.
So there must be something else there.
So the protostellar observations thing, you're saying they don't have very big dispersions?
Well, they certainly have larger dispersions, but they're mostly observed to be transonic rather than particularly strongly supersonic. So one issue about the Kirk et al. Data that we use in Perseus is sometimes they see these double peaked profiles, which could be self-absorption or it could be, you know, a signature of infall. And they say, oh, you know, that's not real, and they divide it into two clumps. So already they sort of prejudice their sample away from...
We had the same thing with Andrew Walsh's
right.
paper. They look like he's evolved two
right.
clumps into two separate ones.
Right.
Right. But you're right. So we don't generally see...
But you're part of the profile strike.
We do see some.
But yeah. Not a lot.
Well, definitely not in the prestellar cases here.
Is your function really an eye thing? Would you say just a dense big S? Or are you using some clump line algorithm?
So we started out with clump fine, and we used it up until last week when there was the observers conference, and they said, well, clump fine is crap, and we don't use it. So, So I redid the analysis just using a local maximum find. So I set, you know, a minimum limit above which, you know, the clumps can be identified, and then it's just local max, local peak finding. Qualitatively, no, surprisingly, because, I mean, the samples are sort of overlapping. But, yeah, we found clump find had various issues, which I don't really want to get into, but this peak finding is definitely better for locating the clumps.
Okay, if there are no more questions, thanks.